I don't know the person who wrote that last song, but they must have been influenced, I think, by Leonard Cohen in the way that they developed their lyrical style. It's rather beautiful, isn't it? I like Leonard Cohen. I like that song. So, all sleep well?
Yeah.
Good. That's good. It was a great time last night. Thank you for those of you who came out. And a special thanks to those who provided such a sumptuous feast for each of us in those homes. It was great, wasn't it, just being able to pack in and feel what it might be like. One of the things that we often hear from folks around the world is, well, our houses are too small to get people in and we can't really have more than four people, you know. And the fact is that we can actually stretch beyond our normal limits if we just give it a go one time. And there it was. Now today what we're going to do is we're going to press in a little bit more into the content of 3DM, and we're going to begin tackling today some of the obstacles that might exist in our lives and in the corporate life of the churches that we serve, the obstacles that might exist to a discipling culture being developed. Clearly, all of us believe that the Great Commission is definitive for each of us. Clearly, all of us believe that Jesus meant it when he said, the task is to make disciples. Some of you may still be in the throes of reflecting on some of the things that we described as definitions of discipleship and how much imitation is involved. But nevertheless, there would be very few Christians who would be prepared to say that the Great Commission is now no longer relevant or definitive for the life of a believer. So, if discipleship is so important that Jesus left it for his last word, then what are the obstacles that prevent us from doing the thing that all of us have in our heart to do? Because clearly, if we were able to do it easily, it would already be happening. The fact is that discipleship is a simple task, but it's very difficult. Simple but hard, like the gospel. It's not easy or complex, like so much of the preaching of the Western Church. It's simple, but nevertheless hard. It's a narrow and difficult path, following Jesus. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at that and in some way begin to chart a path towards a possible future. I'd like you to turn with me to Luke chapter 22 and verse 24. I think we have it up here, but I may read a little further than what we've got on the overhead, so if you want to follow me on your Bible, go right ahead. The context is the Last Supper. The meal has probably been completed. Remember, Jesus has washed the feet of the disciples. He's engaged in the final, beautiful, many-layered discourse that is revealed to us in each of the Gospels. And here, towards the end of the evening, I don't know whether the cigars and the brandy were out, but the guys are beginning to kind of relax and shoot the breeze with one another. And as so often happens amongst men, they begin to ask themselves the question, who's the biggest and the best? And so here in verse 24 it says, also a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors, but you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Just a word on the last few verses there. Jesus is wanting to set into perspective what it is that he's calling them to do. He's calling them to what appears to be a low place, but in calling them to a low place of servant leadership, he's giving them the perspective of what it is that they will receive as they embrace the kingdom that he confers upon them. And the word conferred there is interesting, because it is a word that is drawn out of the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and almost always refers to the covenant that exists between a greater and a lesser person. Diatheke is a covenant word. It's only ever used in that context. And so what Jesus is saying is this. He's saying, I am covenanting with you to give you a kingdom in exactly the same way that my Father covenanted with me to give me a kingdom. And so my kingdom will be your kingdom. And to the degree that I am one with the Father, and therefore I am one with the possession of his kingdom, so you who are one with me will have equal share in the kingdom that I possess. And you'll sit on the 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Now that's a huge promise. And it's a promise underlined in covenant, has been foreshadowed immediately before in the institution of the Lord's Supper, and will be ratified in just a few hours in the blood of Jesus himself. So this is the context in which Jesus is speaking about leadership. There is a very high calling and a very great future and destiny for all of his disciples. But the journey towards that destiny is a journey that is called upon to be one that is like the walk of the Master himself. And he says this. He says, the way that you see leadership operating in the world is not the way that I want you to operate as leaders in the kingdom. In the world, leaders lord it over those that they lead. In other words, leadership is defined by power. It's defined by a power position and by the exercise and the capacity to exercise power over other people's lives. So power is a principal instrument of leadership, and the second instrument of leadership is provision. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority call themselves benefactors. Now, I think we've got a slide to that effect. Doug, are you on slides today or somebody else? These gentlemen over here. So, power and provision are the fundamental components of worldly leadership, Jesus says. Now, of course, there was nobody going to dispute that, not simply because Jesus was the smartest man that they'd ever met, but simply because this was self-evident from the world and the culture in which they lived. The world in which they lived was a stratified world, but not particularly complicated. About 50% of the population of the Roman Empire were enslaved. Now, the slavery of the first century was not the same slavery that besmirched the history of this nation and my own. It was more like the indentured servitude that we saw in the Middle Ages. But nevertheless, a slave or a servant would own no possessions themselves. Occasionally, they may be able to own something, but by and large, a slave, 50% of the population, owned nothing. Now, above them, through the hierarchy of the Greco-Roman world, there were the citizenry. The Roman citizens were the ones who were able to elect the Senate, who theoretically governed the Roman Empire. From the Senate, a Caesar was selected, not always democratically, obviously, but often by tyrannical means. Power was grasped and power was exercised. And so, at the very top, you had Caesar, then you had the Senate, then you had the nobility, from which the Senate was usually selected, the Roman citizens, and then everybody else. The way that they generally divided it was, there was the mobility at the bottom, the mob, as they were called, and the nobility at the top. In England we call them the nobs. There's the mobs and the nobs. And that's basically the way that the world worked. And it worked like that for a very long time. Now the average home, the average person, would constantly be hearing this idea propagated and promulgated throughout the culture. And the idea was this: we function in our lives as prosperous people because of the provision of Caesar. Caesar was the embodiment of the gods. And even if they didn't believe he was an embodiment of the gods, they believed that his exercise of power meant that Pax Romana, the Roman peace, led to the prosperity of the world. And so there would be symbols and effigies and images in every home on many of the utensils that people used in their homes, and certainly in the coinage, that indicated to everybody that they were functioning in Caesar's peace. And because of that, they were able to prosper. And so the idea of power and provision going together was absolutely central to the way that people understood leadership. Leaders were expected to exercise power over those they led. And the social contract was that if you exercise power, then you took responsibility to provide for those that you led. Now, into that world, the church was born. But for the better part of 270, 300 years, the church was pretty much operating under the radar as far as possible. Very often, you found yourself as a Christian in locations and parts of the world where Christianity was being persecuted. And so, public expressions of worship and public avowal of the faith was really discouraged. And so it was the Oikos movement, so well documented by Rodney Stark in his brilliant book, The Rise of Christianity. It was the Oikos movement, the households of Christians, who transformed the world. It was these households, often led by women, often flying under the radar of the perception of the average person, who little by little, in the transformation of one life after the other, began this remarkable work of evangelizing the Roman world. By the time Emperor Constantine had come to his own Kairos moment, to his own moment of decision, by the time he promulgated the Edict of Milan in 313, 50% of the Roman Empire were Christians. 50%. Through years of persecution, no buildings, no budgets, very few clergy, 50% of the most powerful empire the world had ever seen had come to know Jesus as Lord. And of course, with the Edict of Milan, the church was declared the official religion of the Roman Empire. Now, a couple of emperors later tried to reverse the process, but it was too late. Everybody knew that the church had won in the foot race of religions. And so the church was taken and poured into the social fabric of the world that everyone knew. And suddenly, the leaders of the church became members of the Roman nobility. And they began to wear all of the clothes of the Roman nobility. They would wear long, flowing purple robes to indicate their noble heritage and indicate their noble standing. They would wear copes and mitres because, of course, now their position of respect was expected to be recognized by everybody. The church took its place within the social structures of the day and rather than change the social structures, it did eventually, it took maybe 1,000 years, but rather than changing the social structures, it adopted those social structures, and then, with the collapse of the Roman Empire 100 years later, preserved them. 100 years later, Rome was sacked by the Vandals and the Visigoths. 2 years later, they were hammering at the gates of Hippo as Augustine was writing the final lines of his life's work. He died as the city fell, and wrote and created the intellectual framework that would carry the world for the next 1,000 years until a young Augustinian monk, who obviously was identified with Augustine of Hippo himself, was poring over the text of Romans and realized that it was by faith that you were saved. But for 1,000 years, the church had a preeminent place in the world. It had a preeminent place in preserving the social fabric. And what was Roman rule and Roman law became European feudalism. Let's just make sure we understand what that is. Feudalism, as many of you will know, is just a simple outworking of that social fabric that we heard about earlier. It basically means this, that the nobility at the top of the totem pole own everything. And everyone else underneath, the likes of me, maybe not you, I don't know, but the likes of me, the peasantry, owned nothing. So all of the land was owned by royalty and nobility. And if you lived anywhere, you lived on someone else's land. Now, there were the occasional exceptions, but they were very rare. By and large, the land that people lived on, the land that they tilled and worked, that they provided their family with, was land that was owned by somebody else. And that's hugely important, because that's the social fabric of the day. And the leadership was still functioning with power over the people, and with the social contract that in times of need, they would provide for the people. You see, the people were expected to be present on the land and to pay their taxes. It's not complicated. It's somebody else's land, it's somebody else's house, it's somebody else's window, it's somebody else's tree, it's somebody else's field, but you're allowed to work it and till it. And you're allowed to provide for your family, as long as you provide enough for your family and enough to pay your taxes to your feudal lord. So your task as a peasant is to be present on the land and to pay your taxes. Now this is an incredibly stable system that worked for centuries. And frankly, in some parts of the world, still, surprisingly, exists. And it only occasionally was shaken. There's a slow erosion of feudalism with the emergence of European urbanization. You see, there's a real problem about when people live in cities. Who owns that air 3 stories up? It's hard to tax it. Well, they found a way to do that. But who do you tax, and how do you tax the hamburger seller on the street corner of Florence? Well, what of course happened, maybe in a slightly more sophisticated fashion than that, was the emergence of the European merchant class. These were people who had money that other people didn't own. And before long, they became those who lent money to the rich and powerful. They weren't really allowed to lend money, so it was a kind of fiction that they created. But in creating this fiction, they invented the banking system and modern-day commerce. And certain of these merchants, like the Medici family from the 13th century in Florence, became the richest people in the world. So urbanization eroded feudalism to some extent, but it didn't really get rid of it. The big ones that shook feudalism were famine and war. Famine and war. Famine. Well, just think about it. you've been tilling the ground, you've been feeding your family, you've been paying your taxes, and then one year there's no harvest. You eke it out for as long as you can, and then eventually you go to your feudal lord and you say, my family's hungry, we need bread. Now, the social contract was that because they've been paying taxes, not only for their lifetime, but for who knows how many numerous and multiple levels and generations of lifetime before, there should be some provision for the peasantry. But so often what happened was the money and the provision was squandered by the aristocracy of Europe. The French, who had suffered 3 long years of drought with no harvest, came to their king and said, we have no bread. And his wife, a young adolescent teenager, said, well, if they have no bread, why don't they eat cake? Completely separated from the world that most of their subjects lived in. The French peasantry looked at the aristocracy and their royalty, and they said, for that, we're going to kill you. And they killed all of them. And they removed a whole layer of society. They removed all of the aristocracy. And they sought to, in an early form, redistribute the wealth of the nation. They were empowered in their intellects and in their hearts by a revolution that had taken place in these lands just a few years before. But we'll get onto that in a minute. Because war was the other big one. War was always a problem for feudalism. You see, cousin Billy over there just wouldn't be contained in his own territory. And he wanted some of our territory. And so he'd always be moving the frontier posts. He'd always be trying to snatch something somewhere. So eventually, somebody would get upset and they'd pick a fight. And when they picked the fight, they'd go to their peasantry, their serfs, and they'd say, right, now, cousin William over there, he's been a bit of a bad chap, so what we're going to do is we're all going to get together and we're going to give you weapons. I know it's the first time you've ever seen them, but we're going to give you weapons. And we're all going to fight against Billy, and you're going to fight for king and country, and God's on our side. Isn't that great? Meanwhile, over the border, Wilhelm is deeply offended because a group of Bosnian separatists have killed his cousin. They want to get themselves free from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so in Sarajevo, the separatist group, the Black Hand, get a little conspiracy together. The assassins have tuberculosis and will certainly die. Nobody knows how to cure it. And so they put a plot together and they kill Archduke Ferdinand. And the idea was that they would commit suicide afterwards, but they got caught. They died eventually. But of course, this caused a terrible upset. William, Wilhelm, he thought that, well, we probably ought to be supporting our friends down in Austria and Hungary. We ought to really teach those Bosnians a lesson. We ought to go down and kill them. But of course, back in Britain, they're saying, oh no, you mustn't do that. It's not right. I mean, you might have an empire as big as ours soon. I mean, we control the whole world, but you know, we don't want you to have any more territory. So the battle lines are drawn across the farmland of Flanders, and hundreds of thousands of young lives are sacrificed over just a few hundred yards. hundreds of thousands. Whole towns in the north of England have no men left. They've all been killed. And after the First World War, the populace said, do you know what? We've been fighting other people's wars for too long. We think the theories of Marx and Engels that address us and talk about the redistribution of wealth, we think that that might be a better way. And so after the First World War, socialism sweeps Europe. Just as the First World War is ending, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, where the Russian aristocracy have sent tens of thousands of peasants with no weapons into war so that they can use up the ammunition of the German soldiers before they send in their equipped troops. The Bolshevik Revolution sweeps into power. Tsar Nicholas and the Tsarina and the family are assassinated and removed from power. Throughout Europe, socialism rises. In the democratic parts of Europe, socialist members of parliament take their seats for the first time. A new world is imagined without the feudal system that controlled them. And of course, after the Second World War, that process gained momentum. So today you'll go to Europe and the old medieval feudalism is removed because the aristocracy don't own everything. But there is now the expectation that the state is given power and the state is now to provide for us. Now you may criticize that, but it's been going on for an awful long time. And it seems to work for most people. And honestly, those of you who think that Europeans have terrible healthcare, just go to Scandinavia. It's way better than here. I mean, way better than here. And it's all free. Forever. So there's an awful lot of propaganda to and fro, and part of that, you see, is to do with the fact that there is another way. There was another kind of experiment. Right about the time when feudalism was coming under greatest threat because of the famine conditions in Europe, when feudalism was becoming less and less tenable because of the rise of the intelligentsia through the Enlightenment, there were some people who said, you know, we've had enough of Europe. We're going to go and try a new world. And so they came to these shores. And when they came to these shores, they were given great parcels of land by the king or by the queen, who thought that it would be a good idea if they named that parcel of land after themselves. So they called it Maryland or Virginia or Charles Land, the Carolinas. Sometimes they named it after the person they gave it to. A young fellow called William Penn. What should we give him? Well, he likes trees. We'll give him a large place and we'll call it Pennsylvania. How big is it, by the way? Nobody really knows. It's mostly Indians, my lord. And so those settlers came over here. They breasted all kinds of difficulties. They learned from the native people. They struggled to make a life. And before they knew it, the incredible abundance of this land began to bear on them. There were stories in people's journals of men arriving and just being overwhelmed. They'd come from the penury and poverty of Europe. And here they came to the eastern seaboard, where they would be taken in a boat across a river, and a man would drop his coat into the water and catch enough fish for his family for a week. Surely, this was the promised land. Surely, we've reached Canaan's shore. And of course, with all of that possibility, and with a new philosophy framed by the individualism of John Locke and David Hume and the entrepreneurial capitalism of Adam Smith, a new idea began to emerge that everyone could be free to have their own land, to have their own hope, to pursue their own happiness. And we could be free from our tyrannical overlords. We could have a system of government where individuals choose who it is that they put into positions of responsibility, but the power is always marginalized, that the power is always tempered, because it's a democratic system. And that experiment got to the point where pretty much everybody believed that idea who lived here. And they said to their overlords, "We're not paying your feudal taxes anymore." Of course, a bit of a ruckus. But you won through. And the experiment was born. And the greatest nation the world has ever seen emerged from the loamy soil of the Americas. But the virus of feudalism hung on, largely in the European imports that were the denominations. Because when people went to church, the things that were counted was who was present and how much tax are you paying. And the people at the front were given power as long as they provided week after week. And so, though the great experiment had been tried, it never quite made a big impact in the churches. The churches somehow carried on feudalism, but a spiritual feudalism. And so today, all over America, you can walk through the parking lot of any church and you can hear this conversation. "Did you get fed this week?" "Kind of. I kind of got fed, but I thought last week was better. I didn't think he was really on form this week. I'm going to give him a couple more goes, and then if he's not any better, I'm going to go find somewhere else where I can get fed. And that person who feeds me, I'll give them the power over me. And we'll call that church." And Jesus said, "You are not to be like that." Jesus says, the leaders of the world are like that. Jesus says, the leaders of the world, they lord it over them. And they call themselves benefactors, but you are not to be like that. You're to live another way. You're to create another culture. A culture where everyone produces and no one is simply a consumer. A place where everyone has responsibility and no one is given responsibility over anyone else's life. In a way that means that now they are being provided for. No, this is a new culture. It's a culture of discipleship. A culture where each person recognizes that the call is to be fruitful. And in the faithfulness that we heard about earlier, and in the faithfulness of following Jesus, there is the expectation that you'll look around and someone else will be following you. Every Christian is to be fruitful. No Christian is to be provided for. There's another way. And the funny thing is, by and large, I'm speaking to Americans. So you should believe this. You want to try this in Europe, where nobody thinks like this. You have to prove it over and over again from the Bible. But you don't know the proof, do you? This is what God has done, what God has blessed. It's just that you've not been thorough in the principles of that blessing. So how then would we see discipleship emerge? What would be another way if we were not simply the providers of those around us? Well, we would be disciple makers like Jesus. And that would be the kind of person who would learn through a process of invitation and challenge to fashion and shape the person that they are seeking to invest in and who is desiring to follow and imitate your life. Of course, as we said yesterday, if you don't have a life that anyone wants, it's always going to be difficult to make disciples. And so the responsibility is always to be shaped by Jesus in such a way that you have a life that is eminently imitatable. But Jesus, how did he do it? Well, he did it through this process of invitation and challenge. And he calibrated that invitation and challenge. He was seeking to create a culture where high invitation and high challenge were possible. But he would calibrate the challenge to the invitation. And so he would invite, and he would invite a little bit. He'd say, "Come follow me." And they'd say, "Okay, let's do that." So they followed Jesus, and then he challenged them a little bit. Then he invited them a little more. Then he challenged them a bit more. Then he invited them a little deeper. You see, all the time, he's leading to the point where they fully understand that they are one with him, because the invitation is to covenant relationship. The challenge is to kingdom. Is to kingdom representation. But that's a journey. You can't begin there. At first, the real challenges that the disciples had was crowd control. "Who touched me?" said Jesus. "Whoa, there's a crowd, Jesus. I mean, what do you mean?" "Just keep away from Jesus, all right? Don't touch him." "We're the disciples." The invitation would be, "Guys, you've done really well on that little mission trip. You need to get away and rest. Let's go away and rest." What an invitation. Probably at the same time they heard the words, "Come to me, all you who are burdened and heavy laden. I'll give you rest. Learn from me. I'm humble and meek of heart. I'll give you rest for your soul." So they get in the boat and they go across to Bethsaida, and the crowds that have followed the disciples back from their mission trip all run around the top of the lake and they say, "Hey, surprise, you're trying to get away, weren't you?" So Jesus teaches them all day, and the disciples say, "You need to send them away. Yeah, there's not a lot of food around here." Now there's been a deeper invitation. So guess what happens next? A deeper challenge. "You feed them." "What? You feed them. There's 5,000 families here." "Yeah, but we can feed them. What have you got?" "Well, not much." "Well, what have you got?" "Well, it was one of the other guys. He stole the lunch off one of the kids." "Not much. Let's use that." "Gather around, boys. You're going to distribute." That was a very tight circle. They all came in really close. A bit of bread, tail of a fish. "Off you go. Feed the masses." Big challenge. Jesus takes them on retreat. They have to get away from the crowds. It's so difficult. Eventually they're way up in almost pagan territory, Caesarea Philippi, out by the campfire. Caesarea Philippi was the place where the pagans worshipped. It was called the Gates of Hell. There was a great temple to the emperor. There were temples to Pan. There were all kinds of pagan idolatry. And in this countryside, there were few who knew Jesus and his disciples. And on one occasion, Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "Who do people say I am?" Well, some say you're John the Baptist, come back to life. Others, Jeremiah, one of the other great prophets. Who do you say I am? Clearly, Jesus is not wrestling with feelings of insecurity. He wants to see how far the disciples have progressed in their knowledge of him. Because if they know his identity, then that's the beginning of an indication that covenant is possible. Remember, identity is central to covenant. Who do you say? You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, Jesus is always looking for what the Father will do. I only do what I see the Father doing. And so, as he's listening to Simon Peter, he's seeing what the Father's doing in his life, and he says, "Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." And so for that reason, you and I are going to have a covenant from this moment, and I'm giving you my name. Because if you know my identity, then I'll give you my identity, and we can share a covenant. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." The gates of hell were all around them. There was a place where they would throw the sacrifices into the open mouth of a cave called the gate of hell. They were right near it in Caesarea Philippi. But the more important note is this. There's only one person who's called the rock in the Bible. And it's the Lord himself. In the Old Testament, the Lord is the rock. In the New Testament, Jesus identifies himself as the rock when he says at the end of his sermon, he says, "If you're a wise person and you listen to me and put it into practice, you'll be like those who build on the rock. I'm the rock." And Peter, Petros, little rock, "I'm giving you my name. And on the Petra, the big rock, I'll build my church." It's a covenant exchange. And with the name comes the key. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So the covenant exchange has been offered. And there is the promise of the challenge of the kingdom. You get the name and the key. It's amazing, isn't it? The depth of invitation. Of course, we know what happens next. With that depth of invitation comes a much, much stronger challenge. We don't need to look at it, do we? We remember that from that point on, it says in the Gospels, from that point on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples how it was that all this was going to happen. He had to be given up to die. And Peter, we can see him in the text, it's almost as though he sidles up alongside his new covenant brother, the one with whom he shares a name, and he puts an arm around his shoulder and says, "Jesus, Jesus, cheer up. We'll not let anything like that happen to you." And you can see Jesus shaking the hand from his shoulder, saying, "Get behind me, Satan. You're not speaking for God." Now, you may never have said, "Get behind me, Satan," out loud. Occasionally at the church door, you may have said it under your breath. But But that's perhaps because you've never invited anybody into covenant with you. But the nature of discipleship, you see, is invitation and challenge. And this invitation and challenge is a hard wiring in all of our hearts. We all know that it's working. Even today it's been working. You've felt this drawing and then this pushing. You've seen it in all of your relationships. You've noted it in all of your groups. It's the way that God has made us. It is the rhythm of the universe. And this rhythm of invitation and challenge that Jesus keys into, that is articulated in the Word of God who made creation, is articulated by the Word of God as He speaks to His disciples and makes them His followers. This wiring has been identified by good people. One good person is Monty Roberts, a remarkable man who has learned the process of invitation as he talks to horses through this language. They call him the horse whisperer. At the age of 13, he's out on the prairie, not far from here, rounding up wild mustangs with his father. His father believes that you need to break a horse. That means you tie them up and you terrify them until their will is broken. And that's the way that he believes he should raise his son. And Monty believes there must be another way. And at the age of 13, he begins to see the horses talking to each other. He notices that the herd has an individual from another herd seeking to gain access. It may even be a great stallion, but it has to go through the same process as everyone else. The stallion approaches. The leader of the herd separates from the herd. It's the lead mare. And she challenges him. Ears back, eyes to eyes, shoulders square. The new horse sees the challenge, bows his head slightly. At that point, the lead mare opens her flank to the new horse, the vulnerable part of her body. She's a flight animal, of course. She knows that she has to run away, and so she's ready to run if this is a threat that she can't face. With that opening of her flank, the invitation, so the horse comes closer. The challenge is repeated, ears back, eyes to eyes, shoulders square. The new horse bows its head still more, begins to paw the ground. It begins to lick and chew in the manner of a foal in the presence of an adult horse. It's saying, "I'm only little. Will you let me in?" The invitation and challenge is repeated over and over again. Finally, the two horses touch. What Monty calls join up. And from that point, that new horse joins the herd and will never leave it. It's just like Jesus, isn't it? Hasn't Jesus been working in your life like that? Just like he did with his first disciples. Drawing you, pushing you, inviting you, challenging you. Let's watch Monty with one of his horses. On average, for him to fully train a horse, it takes as long as 16 minutes from a wild horse.
This is my father.
Hang on a minute. Stop.
Each time.
Stop. What he's got here is, and you'll see after the introduction, what he's got here is a horse that's very, very skittish. Very, very afraid. And so it takes 23 minutes. We've edited it down to about 4. Watch carefully what happens. See Jesus.
This is my father with an 8-month-old foal. He's tied the rear leg up to suck it out. And here's an older one. Seeing my father breaking horses in this manner drove me to seek out a more humane method.
There you go. Oh, my goodness. That's a pretty wild-looking place. So, I say you want to go away? That's fine. Go on away. But don't go away a little. Go away a lot. And we know that we want her to go both ways because the flight animal is that sort that investigates every opportunity to flee in directions whatever available. And in a round pen, you essentially have a direction left and a direction right available to you. I use this light line so that if it should go out there and hit her, it can't cause her any pain. Because pain would be exactly what we don't want. We've done both directions, and we'll take the pressure off, and we'll start thinking equus. We'll watch for this conversation, and it's coming fast. This ear closest to me is locked on. She's already brought her head off that wall twice now, wanting to come in closer. My eyes on eyes, shoulders square, pushing away. There's licking and chewing. Very nice. We've nailed our prediction on the licking and chewing, and there's the bowing down. There's the bowing down. Very nice. Super good girl. That's so demonstrative right there. That's just as you see the Mustang do it. There's the licking and chewing again. Quite good. Very good conversation. Next round, I will go passive. Good licking and chewing. I will go passive the next round, take my left shoulder by, and then drop my eyes away from her eyes and reverse the whole procedure. There we go. I'll get myself on a 45 now and invite her in. Very nice. Super good girl. There is the moment of join up. You are a good girl. So I'll tell her how nice she is. Invite her into my chest, standing right in front. Don't look her in the eye. I've already done that, and that means go away. Now I want her to be here with me, and she's finding value. And that's join up, and now I'll walk away and attempt to get follow up. Wonderful. Good follow up. And this is the first saddle of her life. And there it is. Okay. We belly over at first. I just want her to carry his weight. He could jump back out of there if she decided that she wanted to take a jump. But it's amazing when you get their confidence that the joined up horse looks up at his first rider, not as an adversary, but as a partner. Certainly with a lot less fear and consternation than the horse who's been started by using the tactics conventional, which are by their very nature adversarial. Very good.
Like Jesus? Isn't that just like the way he's working in our lives all the time? Through a process of invitation and challenge. Through the living out of relationship and responsibility. Call to relationship, challenge to take responsibility. Of course, we can see that, we can understand that, but of course, a lot of the time we live with another reality. And the other reality is the reality often created by the models of leadership that I referred to earlier. And in those models of leadership, we often have conditions where we have high invitation because we're providing for people all the time and on a regular basis. And so we inevitably create people who function in a cozy environment instead of this discipling culture, which is the culture that Jesus creates. The cozy culture is the culture of those of us who've been trained to be chaplains. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter whether you're a liturgical Lutheran or a non-denominational seeker-sensitive pastor. Everyone is producing consumers of one kind or another. Because the culture is high invitation, low challenge, just by its very nature. Now, of course, it's possible to have low invitation and low challenge. And if you have that, people tend to be bored. I'm an Anglican. I know how to build that culture. It's been done tremendously successfully over many hundreds of years. And by and large, what it does is it produces apathy amongst the people. Now, of course, one of the things that happens with many of us is that we rightly assume that children ought to be in a high invitational culture. And so our children's work functions here. We don't think it's appropriate to challenge children in their discipleship, and we give them this incredibly invitational context. And then we expect them, at teenage, to join the adult congregation. There's no invitation, and there's certainly no challenge. They get bored, and they leave. Occasionally, we're enlightened enough to ensure that the youth work is as invitational as the children's work. But at some point, they're going to step into an environment that is not calibrated to their particular needs as an emerging adult. And invariably, we find that we lose them. And it's because they descend into the bottom left-hand corner. Sometimes we have a culture of high challenge and low invitation, like those of you who are church planters. It's incredibly stressful. Because high challenge all the time, with little invitation, is all about getting the job done, making the breakthrough, doing it as well next week as you did last week. But of course, those of you who have a staff who are seeking to deliver this often discover that the staff live here. And there are other words that go along with stress, like discouraged. Because you're trying to deliver this every week, and no doubt you're going to be stressed. So, here's the question. It used to be called the $64,000 question. You can't buy much for $64,000 these days, can you? Whatever it is now, the very expensive question. How do you get from the top left, where most of us live in congregational life, to the top right? How do you get there? Well, here's the problem. You can't just go this way, unfortunately. Because if you could, we'd all be celebrating and that would be the end of the workshop. You see, here's the problem. We're finite beings. And if we spent all of our resources to create a high invitation culture, and we want to go into a high invitation and high challenge culture, we have to use some of the resources that we've been applying to invitation to challenge. That means time, money, and effort need now to be applied to challenge where they used to be exclusively applied to invitation. And inevitably, what that means is that the people think that you're mean. Because they think that you're withdrawing some of the invitation. And so inevitably, what happens for churches like yours and mine is that we go through what we at 3DM call the valley of the shadow of death. You may lose people, because there are some people just down the road who'll just keep on doing the high invitation culture. You may discourage people because they say, well, hang on, you used to be a nice person. Why are you calling us to this repentance stuff all the time? What we've noted is this, is that inevitably there are challenges through the valley, but what we've noted is that the indicators of commitment all rise. Very often, you'll lose a few people, but the income of the church increases. Astonishing. We've seen it dozens and dozens of times now. The real thing is this, is not whether you gain or lose in the valley, it's what happens in the valley. And what happens in the valley is what the psalm tells us happens in the valley. At the beginning of the psalm, the sheep is saying about her shepherd that he's marvellous. But she's talking about him. She has her head over the fence, bragging to her neighbour, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. But then, as the journey of the shepherd with the sheep from the winter pasture to the summer pasture, from the valley, the plain to the summer meadows, as the journey begins, the only way to get to the mountaintop is through the narrow defiles and valleys. And so the shepherd and the sheep have to enter into the place where the predators live, the valley of the shadow of death. But in the valley, the sheep stop talking about the shepherd and start talking to the shepherd. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. Your challenge and invitation are found in the valley. The rod, that's the thing that the shepherd would use to poke the sheep and get them moving, to push them along. The staff, that would be the thing with the hook on the end that would draw the sheep towards them, would be the instrument of rescue. In the valley, we find the comfort of the invitation and challenge of the shepherd. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, your rod, your staff, they comfort me. And as I go through the valley with you, learning how you calibrate invitation and challenge, I come to the summer pasture, spread like a table full of the spring flowers in the presence of my enemies. And every day is like an overflowing cup, like a daily anointing. And from here, I can see as far as the house of the Lord. It's worth it, going through the valley. And all of you have been through the valley, maybe not kind of reflectively, you've just kind of gritted your teeth and gone through it. But all of us have gone through it, and all of us have led other people through it. And here's the thing. We can't reach the mountain unless we go through the valley. And so, we just want to be honest with you. It doesn't matter whether you come on this journey with us, or you take the journey yourself or with others, you'll go through the valley. But to get here is wonderful. And it is the fulfillment of the Great Commission. Because right there, we made disciples. So, this is what we're going to do right now. We're going to do what we did yesterday. We're going to take a moment just to pause. What out of that excursion through European history, who knows what else we talked about today, what out of that did you feel the Lord impressed upon you? What was it that he said to you? What is it that settled in your heart? Just take a moment, be quiet. Just take a moment, let's record that. Just be aware of that. And then in about a minute or so, I'll ask you to share that with one other person.